Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
And good afternoon. It's a beautiful, cool fall day here in Fairfax, Virginia. And we want to thank you for joining us for this edition of Military Monday. It's going to be an interesting day because we're going to talk about what some people might consider a little story. And I would just say it's a little story that came to me in a rather odd fashion a few weeks ago. Those of you who listen here regularly know that we regularly host authors from our friends over at the U.S. Naval Institute Press in Annapolis, Maryland. The reason's real simple. Over a period of almost 100 years or more, these people have put out some of the finest in professional military journalism, books, reference materials, and just intellectual thought. And about 2 weeks ago, I got a rather interesting little book in the mail. There's a very fine lady over at Naval Institute Press, their publicity director, Judy Heiss, who likes to send me books in the hope that maybe I'll find a fit for them here on Military Monday. And this one caught my eye. It caught my eye because it didn't fit. It's a little story about a time most Americans would like to forget, and in many cases have forgotten. It's called The Lucky Few, and it's the story of a U.S. destroyer escort and its part, some would say small, but I think others might disagree with that, in the evacuation of South Vietnam during the spring of 1975, which was not a good time for America. It was the end of our, what was up to that time, our longest war, one that many people thought we had lost. Certainly we had not won it. Our ally in the region, South Vietnam, was being overrun by their North Vietnamese enemies, and the job was simple. Get all the Americans out of South Vietnam, clear out. Some would say cut and run. Others would just say the word evacuation. But in addition, there was another job to do, and that job was to evacuate key South Vietnamese personnel, everybody from agricultural specialists to intelligence personnel to military officers, people who had helped us during the previous decade of war, but knew that they and their families would be captured, probably killed, certainly imprisoned, and harshly treated. The book, The Lucky Few, is by a fine historian up in Maryland, Jan K. Herman. He is with us today, and we're going to let him tell this story the way we like to. I'm going to just prompt him along, and I think you're going to enjoy this little story, which you probably have never heard. Jan, are you there, sir?
I am, certainly.
Jan?
It's an honor to be here.
Oh, we're really pleased to have you. As I said, I'm one of those suckers who loves little books and little stories that have amazing implications and impossible odds against them. You know, what can I say? Too many times I watch The Guns of Navarone and The Bridge on the River Kwai, I guess. But talk to us a little bit and tell us a little bit about what was the situation in Southeast Asia in the spring of 1975, as well as here in Washington, D.C.
Well, the war, as you know, had been going on for a long time. It was probably the most controversial war that we were involved in, certainly since the Civil War, and probably no war since the Civil War had really torn this nation apart the way Vietnam had. Anyone who was around at that time, whether you were in the military or whether you were a civilian back during that period, knows how the country was divided over whether we should be in Vietnam or whether we shouldn't, whether we should leave. And, of course, the Tet Offensive in 1968 was a kind of a watershed. It was after that time that the opposition to the war grew in intensity, and if anyone who was anywhere at that time remembers how the streets were filled with demonstrators, and it was a sad time in our history. The war kind of wound down in about 1973 with the Paris Peace Accords, the peace accords that Henry Kissinger, who was Secretary of State at the time, had so found important to try to end the war for the United States. And as the peace accord was signed in 1973 in Paris, it really didn't leave South Vietnam in a very comfortable position. It was, in a sense, it was a comfortable way for the United States to leave South Vietnam. What I mean is it put a good face on something, and some might argue whether it was a good face or not, but it provided a means for the United States to get out of Vietnam. But peace accords, although they're quite complicated, there were really three basic parts to them. One was that the North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese armies could hold the positions they already occupied at that time in 1973. And that meant, really, that there was territory in South Vietnam being occupied by North Vietnamese troops, and they could remain in those positions. The second part of that, the armies could resupply. Now, taking advantage of the situation, the North Vietnamese built a vast network of roads. The famed Ho Chi Minh Trail, portions of it were expanded and actually paved. And the North Vietnamese found the opportunity advantageous, and they began laying oil pipelines south for the future meaning the final offensive. There was no doubt in anyone's mind, certainly the North Vietnamese minds, that they were going to conquer South Vietnam. They'd been working on it for a long time, and that was the ultimate goal. So anyway, they laid oil pipelines, fuel lines, and they also began setting up radio networks. The third part of that, the third major part of that peace accord was, it provided, of course, for the release of American prisoners of war who had been in Vietnam, in North Vietnam, some of them in the infamous Hanoi Hilton, our aviators who had been shot down over Vietnam. So that was kind of the situation. In March, early March, it would have been about the first week of March of 1975, so this was 2 years after the fact, the North Vietnamese finally found it advantageous to strike. This was going to be the final offensive. And so, violating the terms of the treaty or the accords, they struck in South Vietnam with a ferocity that hadn't been seen previously. Knowing that the Americans were now no longer there, American troops had been withdrawn from South Vietnam, this was now going to be a conventional war. It was not going to be a guerrilla war any longer the way the Viet Cong had fought it. It was going to be a conventional war now with tanks and artillery, and certainly the North Vietnamese had no fear that American B-52s would slow their advance. The Americans
It's worth noting here, it's obviously worth noting, Jan, that it wasn't just a simple fact. It was law by this time. By now, Richard Nixon had left office. Gerald Ford was president, but he had his hands tied by both the treaty as well as something called the McGovern-Hatfield Amendment, what we today call the War Powers Act. Please explain what options he did not have here.
He did not have the option of continuing a war without congressional approval, and there would be no congressional approval at this point. There was still support for South Vietnam monetarily. There was roughly $720 million that was supposed to be sent to South Vietnam to help them supply and resupply, but Congress decided they would not even provide that minuscule amount of money. And in fact, it was in the second or third week of April of 1975, with the South Vietnamese on the run, literally. I mean, the country was already almost completely cut off. It was cut in half. The North Vietnamese had struck the Central Highlands. They had sliced eastward, and they had cut South Vietnam in two. And they advanced down along Highway 1 on the coast of Vietnam. City after city began falling to the North Vietnamese. And the recognition was that the war was essentially finished as far as the United States was concerned. And President Ford gave a speech in New Orleans on the 23rd of April in which he declared the war finished. He said it in plain language. And so now there was nothing to be done except try to get the Americans who were still there out safely and as you pointed out earlier, those what we'd like to call sensitive South Vietnamese, that is, those South Vietnamese who had helped us during the war and whose lives were now in imminent danger once the North Vietnamese consolidated their control over what had been South Vietnam. So it was a matter of evacuating them, and that's really where the story begins, the story of the lucky few begins. The immediate goal, of course, was to get those Americans who were still there, and there were a number of Americans. There were CIA operatives, there were military advisors, there were State Department officials who were still there, and the ambassador at the time, Graham Martin, who was a man in his early 60s, not really well thought of at the time, and he had a different opinion. His opinion was that the war was not lost. He felt that he should be encouraging the South Vietnamese to stiffen their resistance. He promised them that help was on the way, although help was not on the way. And he felt that preparing for the evacuation, tip off the South Vietnamese, that we were going to leave, and that panic would ensue. And so Ambassador Martin really made few, if any, preparations for the departure. And so there were lists of names that were still around in the embassy of South Vietnamese who had been helping us. These lists had not been destroyed. There was really no preparation, really, or very little preparation for the evacuation of South Vietnam until almost the last minute. And that became a real issue. And those who were around at that time recall, certainly watching on their TV screens, the chaos and the anarchy that developed in Saigon as the North Vietnamese forces surrounded the city and began firing rockets into the city, certainly firing rockets at the Tan Son Nhut Air Base, which was also Saigon's municipal airport. It kind of had a dual function. And so, as I say, the preparations had not been made, although there was a plan. There were actually two plans. There was Plan A. Plan A was to get the people out using fixed-wing aircraft. Military and civilian fixed-wing aircraft that would go into Tan Son Nhut and evacuate people in an orderly fashion. But the attacks on Tan Son Nhut happened so quickly that the runways were cratered to the point they could not be used by fixed-wing aircraft. So they had to go to Plan B, which was called Operation Frequent Wind, which was the helicopter evacuation of Saigon and its environs. And it was supposed to work this way. People were supposed to meet at various locations around the city. These were Americans and South Vietnamese who had learned in advance that they would be evacuated. They would meet at bus stops. Buses would carry them to certain areas where helicopters would be landing. They would meet in soccer fields where, again, helicopters could land. And that system actually broke down in chaos. And helicopters landed where they could. Now, in order to support this effort, there was a flotilla of Navy ships offshore, and these consisted of amphibious ships, aircraft carriers, smaller vessels that would be protecting the larger fleet. There were roughly 44 or 45 of these vessels offshore. One of them was the USS Kirk, which was a destroyer escort, fairly small vessel, roughly 430 feet long, and not equipped for fending off aircraft. It was a ship that had been designed for a specific purpose, and that was to help fight the Cold War. It was a ship that was designed for anti-submarine activity, so it was supposed to defend a carrier task force against hostile Soviet submarines if the Cold War had suddenly turned hot. It was equipped with torpedoes and ASROCs, which were rocket-fired torpedoes, and sonar and that type of thing. It had one 5-inch deck gun, which was which wouldn't have offered much defense if the ship had come under some type of concerted air attack. But anyway, the ship was there to help protect the fleet from hostile North Vietnamese. Now, mind you,
please
by this
tell us
time,
about the man who was in command at the time, because what he did over the next couple of weeks is kind of a living legend in the U.S. Navy.
Well, Donald Whitmire was the task force commander. He was aboard the USS Blue Ridge, which was the kind of the flagship and the control ship of that particular task force. He had not been given a lot of guidance. This whole thing was playing out pretty much on a minute-by-minute basis. And it's interesting to note, of course, nowadays when we have satellite phones and satellite communications as sophisticated as they are now, there was communication with the Pentagon, but it was slow. It wasn't instantaneous. And it's interesting, in the course of writing my book, I interviewed the former Secretary of Defense, Schlesinger, James Schlesinger, and he pointed that out to me. He said, you know, I let those people, they were on their own out there. I trusted them to do the right thing because I could not communicate with them on a minute-by-minute basis. Nowadays, the kinds of decisions that were made in that theater of operations might not be made now because everyone is so afraid of what might happen. They demand instant communication with their bosses, pretty much to cover their butts, if I may be so presumptuous to say that.
Oh,
but
please,
those
be
days,
presumptuous. We love that here.
We
love presumptuous. Let's talk a little bit about the man who was the captain of the Kirk, because he too would have an amazing set of things that he would face over the next couple of weeks.
Well, the commander of the USS Kirk was Lieutenant Commander Paul Jacobs. Paul Jacobs was not your run-of-the-mill skipper at that point. For one thing, he did not come into the Navy via Annapolis, the Naval Academy. He was from Maine. And he had grown up in a rather austere situation in Maine. His father had been in the Merchant Marine during World War II. He ended up going to the Maine Maritime Academy. His father, by that time, had been a professor at the Maine Maritime Academy, and Paul Jacobs went through the program to become a marine engineer. And he came into the Navy that way, via the Maine Maritime Academy. He had several commands at sea prior to being assigned to USS Kirk, and he had a wonderful personality. He was a born leader. It didn't matter which ship he was assigned to, his crews adored him. He took care of his men. He got the best out of them, and they would pretty much do anything for him, which is a sign of leadership you often don't find these days. But anyway, he was assigned to the Kirk, and the Kirk had its WestPac crews, and they got wrapped up in this mission. They were told that their job would be to patrol 12 miles offshore off the South Vietnamese port of Vung Tau, and their job was to interdict, if necessary, North Vietnamese aircraft that might try to harass the evacuation. So they're cruising back and forth. They had a helicopter deck because they had what's called a Lamps helicopter aboard, a helicopter that was used for dropping sonobuoys in the water and trying to detect sounds of Soviet submarines and, if need be, to sink them. It was also armed. But at the time, their sole helicopter was out of order. Its engine was down, and it was in its hangar on the deck. There was a collapsible hangar on the back end of their helo deck. So they had a helicopter deck, and that's important to note at this point. Anyway, the Kirk was cruising back and forth in a prescribed pattern.
And by the way, can we just say real quickly, this is right on the cusp of when America is about to go all volunteer. So the kids who are about to do what you're going to talk about, these are not professionals. These are drafted young men. All men, because women were not at sea at the time. This is the old Navy. This is not today's Navy, right?
Well, I would say yes to a certain point. They weren't drafted, but they were you know, probably four-year guys, maybe one enlistment type of people. Some of them had more experience than that, but they were, and I think it's interesting to note, like any sailors, they were trained for combat. That was the idea. They were trained to go to war. But they were from they were from every part of the United States. Probably like any aspect of our history, the crew on the Kirk was the melting pot, if you will. You saw all kinds of names. There were Asian Americans. There were African Americans. There were Latinos. There were Anglos. There were all kinds of people on the ship, and they were young men. That's also important to note. The average age was about 19, if you didn't count the if you didn't count the officer. The officers aboard. Your average age was somewhere between 19 and 20, perhaps. So they were young men, and they were a cross-section of America at the time. It's also interesting to note that at that time there were a lot of racial issues in the Navy. Certainly, they may have been on the Kirk, but I certainly didn't find any because Captain Jacobs, he pulled his whole crew together. There were no racial incidents. Everybody on that crew felt like they were part of that crew. And men told me they had been on other ships, other larger ships previously, special carriers, and they were afraid about the situation. When they came to Kirk and they realized what kind of a ship it was, their fears were put to rest. They realized they were part of a very strong and mutually supportive crew.
And for our listeners, if you'd like to call in and talk to either myself or Jan, the call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. To say it again, our call-in number is 347-945-7246. So it's the end of the road in South Vietnam, and you know, Washington has decided it's time to get the ambassador, his staff, and everybody out of the embassy. And we go ahead and dispatch a force of Marines off of the amphibious ships via helicopter into the compound, and we begin to initiate the final evacuation of American presence in South Vietnam. What happens on that amazing and tragic day?
Well, as I pointed out, the Kirk is doing its thing. It's cruising back and forth in a prescribed pattern. Searching for, looking for the possibility of enemy attack. None. No, there is no enemy attack. And as the helicopters go in from the amphibs and the carriers, they're CH-47s and or 46s. I'm sorry, CH-46s and CH-53 heavy lift helicopters, manned by Marines and also Marine Corps crews, and also Navy helicopters. They go in to evacuate the Americans and the Vietnamese, and as they go back out to sea, this is going to be a shuttle service. They're going to go in, they're going to pick up passengers, they're going to fly out to the decks, they're going to land, discharge their human cargoes, they're going to refuel and go back in, and they're going to do this back and forth until they've evacuated everybody needs to be evacuated. Well, as they go in for the first time and they load up the aircraft and they fly back out over the ocean, heading out to the fleet, the pilots look in their rearview mirrors and they see something quite astounding. What they see are hundreds, literally hundreds, of South Vietnamese Air Force and Army Hueys, only small helicopters, following them back out to sea. And if you look at it from the point of view of the South Vietnamese, they know that the Americans are leaving. They see them heading out to sea. They know they're going someplace. They've got helicopters, they've got fuel, and they've got lots of passengers because a typical South Vietnamese Air Force or Army pilot might have his helo, he might fly to his town, his village where his family was, load them aboard, and then say, you know, I got plenty of space on board. Anybody wants to go, climb aboard. Well, some of them didn't really realize what they were wishing for because these helicopters were so overloaded that many of them were too heavy to even take off. But anyway, they flew out to sea, and again, those who remember those final scenes, the final death of South Vietnam, so to speak, you can remember some of those helicopters were packed. A helicopter that might take, for example, a Huey might take perhaps 10 to 12 passengers would be packed with 25 to 30 men, women, and children, some people holding on to the skids. They were so panic-stricken as to what might become of them when the North Vietnamese showed up that they would have done anything to get out. And these helicopters start heading out to sea looking for decks to land on. And they start landing on carrier decks. On some of them run out of fuel and ditch with the loss of life. And the Kirk is seeing this. They know what's going on. They look up, the crew looks up, and they see these helicopters. The sky is smeared with the exhaust of hundreds of these helicopters heading around. And they feel, wouldn't it be great to get one of these helicopters, to have one of them land on us and we could take home a trophy? But they watch, and none of these helicopters decide to land. They're looking for larger decks to land on. Now, mind you, many of these...
Just a little context here. How big was the commander of Task Force 77 expecting this evacuation to be, and what was really coming at him in terms of raw numbers of humanity aboard these helicopters?
Well, he was briefed that there would be two or three trips of these helicopters going in picking up Americans and South Vietnamese. He had not a clue. He was as shocked and surprised as anyone that all these other helicopters that he hadn't counted on were coming out. And again, I'm talking about hundreds of helicopters and no place to put them. His decks were now, as we said in the Navy, foul decks. In other words, the decks had aircraft on them and there was no place to land. So decisions had to be made right on the spot. What to do? I mean, here are people who are going to die unless they have a place to land. They're going to end up in the drink. They're going to drown. There are kids. There are all kinds of people. What do you do? Well, the decision was made along the line. I think it was made independently that what do we do? If they land on our decks, we get them off, and to make room for more, we shove these aircraft over the side. And so that's what happened on many of these ships. As the Vietnamese helicopters would land, they would get the people off. And then these helicopters, these Hueys, which weighed about 2.5 tons, were dragged over to the side and thrown into the water. Well, as this is going on, of course, the Kirk is watching all this action, and they feel left out. They really feel, we're not really part of this. We want to be part of this. There's a lot of excitement going on, and we want to be part of it. So Captain Jacobs gets one of his crew members, a storekeeper on the ship who had been to Vietnam previously on another tour and had learned rudimentary Vietnamese, and he gets on the guard channel and he announces in his rudimentary Vietnamese that we have a clear flight deck, so HEL 1087, land here. And within probably 10 minutes of this announcement over the radio, they look up and they see their first Huey circling overhead with the intent of landing. And within a few moments, they coax it into the flight deck, and he lands successfully, and they take the people off. And they look up, and to their horror, there were three or four Hueys on a final approach to the ship. And they realize that they can't land all these helicopters. Again, I said it earlier, be careful what you wish for, because they're not only going to take one trophy home, they're going to suddenly be taking a lot of trophies home if they don't crash on the deck and kill everybody. So Captain Jacobs makes the same decision as is made on many of the other ships. He just says, over the side. And as these helicopters begin landing, the people are taken off, and they begin pushing these helicopters over the side. There's an additional problem that they're facing. They don't know these people who are getting off onto their deck. Many of them are armed. They've left home with pistols, with semi-automatic rifles. They've got all kinds of, in fact, there some people have hand grenades, some of the military people who are on these things. And they don't know whether there might be some North Vietnamese involved in this who might want to take over the Kirk. So they have to provide for security. And very quickly they set up a security system where the people are disarmed and the ordnance and whatever are put in a locker, and many of these people have money. They've taken money with them. They've taken gold. They've taken everything they own. And they could be fighting amongst themselves. So they take all the money away. They take the gold, these little gold bars that people have sewn in their clothing. They take it all, and they put it in a safe, and they give the people receipts for them. So when they leave the ship, there won't be any question as to what they left. So now they have roughly within a few hours, they've got about 130, 140 refugees. Again, men, women, and children, and they need to provide for them. And the crew, with the snap of a finger, and it's literally with the snap of a finger, they turn from warriors to humanitarian assistance providers. And they begin taking care of kids. They begin diapering babies. They begin providing food and water and medical care to these people. So it's clearly an amazing transformation that takes place within just a few hours aboard USS Kirk.
Now, you talk about Hueys coming in with 10, 12, 20, 30 people aboard. They land. They're evacuated off the bird. The bird gets pushed over the side into the South China Sea. And just minutes later, there's another one coming in. How long does this evolution go on? And how many people, at the end of the day, are there aboard USS Kirk?
Well, Kirk recovers roughly 12 to 13 Hueys in the course of that day. It would have been the 29th of April of 1975. They would have recovered roughly 140 refugees to take care of. And so it's a very busy day. But, you know, what's most interesting about it, or frightening, I should say, that halfway through this operation, which goes on all day, it goes on till midnight, in fact, where there's another where they actually rescue two U.S. Marine flyers who have to ditch their Cobra in the sea near the Kirk, having run out of fuel. But in the course of the day, there's something else. A very dramatic event takes place. It's kind of I don't want to call it kind of a divider in the day, but it is, really. As they're recovering these smaller aircraft, there's a lull in the action for probably about 15 or 20 minutes, and then the crew members hear an engine or engines. They don't quite know what it is, but it's a lot louder than what they're used to hearing from the Hueys. And they look up and they see a CH-47 Chinook, which was the largest helicopter in the South Vietnamese inventory. A huge helicopter carrying many troops and could even carry several howitzers and vehicles. It was a very large two-engine helicopter. And they see it coming toward the Kirk with the intention of trying to land. Well, they immediately realize that if this thing tries to land on that small flight deck on the Kirk, it's going to probably mean a terrible human disaster. The rotors of the helicopter.
I mean, it's worth noting, the flight deck of the Kirk was already slightly fouled because the collapsible hangar was fully extended with the SH-2 Sea Sprite Lamps helicopter in it. So there was no way you were going to get an aircraft the size of a Chinook even to touch down the back end of it on the deck there.
That's correct, and with the size, with the radius of its rotors, it was immediately recognized that the rotors would take out a part of the superstructure of the ship, probably meaning a fuel dump on the deck and explosions and God knows what else. They just knew there was no way they were going to allow this huge helicopter to land or even attempt to land. So they waved him off, and he came back, and in rudimentary English, he said that he was low on fuel, he had passengers aboard, women and children, and he could not make it to a larger ship. He couldn't make it very far at all. Could they please find a way to help him? Anyway, the decision was made rather quickly that if he could hover over the fantail deck of the Kirk, if he could hover maybe 15 feet above the deck to make sure that his rotors cleared the flight deck of the Kirk, which was one rung above, if you will, was slightly above the fantail deck. If he could hover, they would make every attempt to catch whatever passengers could jump from the open door of the aircraft. And so he came in and managed to hover the aircraft. This guy was a professional. He was not an amateur, although he had never flown over water previously and never hovered over the deck of a moving ship before. He was very skilled, and he was able to keep the helicopter in a stable hover as people began jumping from the co-pilot's open door. a mother threw her baby out, an infant, and the crew standing below were hauling in children and even small adults as if they were pulling in touchdown passes. And it was one of those lucky things that no one was seriously hurt in this evolution. They managed to get all 10 of the passengers off the helicopter, and I think the worst injury was a sprained ankle and some abraded knees. But now the pilot now was alone aboard, and what was he going to do? Well, there was only one thing to do, and that was to ditch his helicopter. Well, he had never really been trained to ditch a helicopter at sea before. That was not part of the South Vietnamese Air Force training. But what he did was he took the helicopter off the starboard quarter of the Kirk. He got out of his flight suit, somehow managed to keep this thing in a stable hover by himself, which was quite a feat. He got rid of his pistol, and then at the last minute, he swerved the helicopter to the right. He banked it to the right. He dove out the left-hand door, the emergency door, the pilot's door, landed in the water. As the helicopter hit the water, it exploded. The rotors were still going at full tilt, and they hit the water, and shrapnel went flying everywhere. And it settled into the water, and the pilot disappeared. And everyone looked, and they saw red in the water, and they figured, that's a shame. He got everybody off, but he died. And then suddenly, his head popped to the surface, and he was swimming for his life. The red they had seen in the water was not blood at all, but red hydraulic fluid. And they immediately, everyone started diving. I shouldn't say everyone, but a lot of the sailors saw this little man floating in the water, and they dove in to try to save him. In fact, it became an issue that instead of having to rescue one man, suddenly they had about 12 guys to rescue, 11 or 12 crew members who had dove into the water to save this guy. And they put the motor whaleboat over the side. I guess it was already in the water. They went in and they rescued the pilot, and they brought him back. And so in this very dramatic rescue, all the passengers were saved, all 11 passengers and pilot. Live to tell the tale. And when I say live to tell the tale, I mean that when I was doing interviews for the book and I was talking to Captain Jacobs and several of the other crew members, I said, that was quite a bit of airmanship that South Vietnamese pilot displayed. He's really a hero. Does anybody remember his name? I'd sure love to talk with him. And they looked at me and said, well, you know, in the heat of battle, we never really got his name. We don't know who he is. But we'd sure like to meet him. He certainly would have a job on this ship, or if we still had it, we would give him the job as a helicopter pilot because he was so skilled. Well, happy to say we found the pilot. We found Ba Nguyen, who flew that helicopter, and we interviewed his son, who was a little boy, a sixth at the time, who jumped out the back end. We interviewed his mother, and it had a happy ending. But it was a very dramatic interlude in this whole operation.
Now, it's worth noting, this was the little part of the rescue. And when we come back from the messages we're going to run here in just a second, we're going to talk about the big rescue. Right, Jan?
Yes, we are.
All right. We're going to take a quick break for some network messages. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network. Tune in to Military Monday with host John D. Gresham, author, military historian, and journalist. John delves into a unique aspect of U.S. military history, as well as current events and issues affecting our men and women in uniform. Featuring exceptional guests, military experts, and authors, Military Monday with John D. Gresham entertains, informs, and encourages listeners to support those who put it all on the line for freedom. Military Monday with John D. Gresham, Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network.
All right. We're back from our messages. Are you there, Jan?
I am.
Now, I was being just a tad flippant a minute ago when we were talking about this was the little part of the rescue. What was the total count of personnel that were brought aboard the USS Kirk that day?
Roughly 140.
Not a bad day's work for a ship that had a broken helo and a fouled deck.
Not bad at all.
Yet that was not the big part of what they were involved in. And I'd like you to go and take us now to Washington, D.C., where a name we're going to hear a lot about in American history later, one Richard Armitage, is given an assignment.
Well, Richard Armitage, and some of you might know, was certainly in the last administration, the last Bush administration. Richard Armitage was Deputy Secretary of State when Colin Powell was the Secretary. So he had quite a career. But he started off as an Annapolis man. He was a Navy man, a Naval Academy graduate, had been assigned to a destroyer in the Pacific, in the Western Pacific, had several tours of duty in Vietnam. He really turned out to really love South Vietnam in many ways. He loved the culture. He loved the people. He learned the language pretty much on his own. I mean, he had some training in Vietnamese, but he learned it on the street. And he learned it to such a degree that he could speak South Vietnamese. And as some South Vietnamese have told me since, he could, with the snap of a finger, he could go from a northern dialect or a southern dialect to a northern dialect. He could speak both dialects of the Vietnamese people, those who lived in North Vietnam and those who lived in South Vietnam. He was involved in many activities in the Brown Water Navy at the time in Vietnam in the Mekong River Delta. He helped train South Vietnamese troops in ambush tactics. He was a doer. He was a guy who loved to be in the thick of the action. His career took a funny turn after the signing of the peace accords in 1973. He didn't agree with the nation's policy on signing those peace accords. In fact, he was very angry about the terms. He saw it as a sellout of the South Vietnamese of our South Vietnamese allies. And as a result, he resigned his commission in the U.S. Navy. And I remember telling me very dramatically in an interview, several interviews I did with him, he said he saw the 73 peace accords pretty much the way it would be if you had made a woman pregnant and then run out on her. That's the terms he used to describe how he felt about that, about those peace accords. But yet, having resigned from the Navy, the pull of Vietnam was just too strong for him. He still cared deeply for the Vietnamese people. And he went back on his own several times as a private citizen to see how things were going. Well, we're now in 1975 where everything is falling apart. And Richard Armitage makes one of these trips on his own and sees exactly how horrible things are, how badly things are turning against the South Vietnamese. And he goes back to Washington and he tells some colleagues that he's had how badly things are. And so within a short time, he's hired to work in the Defense Department as a special agent for the Secretary of Defense at the time, James Schlesinger. And he's given an assignment, and his assignment essentially is to go back to South Vietnam and to try to destroy as much of the equipment that we had given them as possible, things like computers, of course, at the time, rudimentary computers, but to go back and break things, as he put it. So he went back to South Vietnam, and when he got there, he realized he didn't have a lot of time to break things. Things were deteriorating so quickly, and the North Vietnamese were advancing so quickly that there was very little he could do. But then he saw another problem, the issue of what becomes of the South Vietnamese Navy? What is going to happen if the South Vietnamese Navy, if they don't evacuate those ships? The North Vietnamese are going to take them over, and many of his former friends and colleagues will be imprisoned or killed. And so, without any authorization from his bosses in Washington, He and a high-ranking Vietnamese naval official named Kim Do, Captain Kim Do, they come up with a plan to evacuate the South Vietnamese Navy. And it's to be done the first week of May of 1975. Well, things deteriorate so quickly that he goes back to the Vietnamese naval headquarters on the Saigon River as North Vietnamese troops are almost entering the city, and he says, we can't wait for the first week of May. We have to do it now. Tonight, we have to evacuate these ships. And the ships, what remains of the South Vietnamese Navy, remember, these are vessels that had been given or loaned to the South Vietnamese by the U.S. Navy. So they're, many of them are obsolescent or obsolete ships. They're LSTs, LSMs, Coast Guard cutters, swift boats. It's a motley assortment of ships. And many of them are not even functioning very well. They need yard work, but there's no time for that. And so he says, we're going to evacuate the ships. We'll go down the Saigon River. We'll go to an island off the coast of South Vietnam called Con Son Island. And we'll rendezvous there, and I will have the U.S. Navy come and rescue your ships. Now he's acting on his own. He has no authorization from Washington. He's hoping that his bosses will agree to the plan that he's come up with. And he flies out to the USS Blue Ridge on a helicopter, again, as Tan Son Nhut Airport is being rocketed by the North Vietnamese. He flies out to the USS Blue Ridge to talk to Admiral Whitmire and tell Admiral Whitmire what he has promised the South Vietnamese Navy. And he's been in the field for a couple of days. He needs a shave. His clothes are filthy. He arrives on the deck of the USS Blue Ridge, and he lands on the deck, and he's armed with his 45 and a shoulder holster, his 1911 45 and a shoulder holster, and he has no identification. He's lost his wallet. He has no passport. He has no means of identifying himself. And he sees a flag lieutenant on the deck, and he walks over to him, and he says, I need to see Admiral Whitmire right now. And the lieutenant looks at him and says, who are you? And he tells him who he is, and the lieutenant looks very skeptically and said, you think you're going to get to see Admiral Whitmire? You need to identify yourself better than how you have already identified yourself. And Armitage, being a quick thinker, he says, you go tell Admiral Whitmire that when I was at the Naval Academy in the athletic barracks, I used to dress under his picture every day. Well, Admiral Whitmire, Don Whitmire, had been a football star at Alabama and also at the Naval Academy, and there was a portrait of him that hung in the athletic facility. And that was the secret handshake. At least that's what Armitage hoped it would be. And sure enough, within 15 minutes, the lieutenant came back and says, Admiral Whitmire will see you now.
Now, it's worth noting for anybody who does not know Rich Armitage, this man is a walking mountain of a man. He's big, and there ain't no fat on him. He is just a big muscle, not to mention an amazing mind.
He's so large. I've met him on many occasions. He can be a little bit intimidating when you first meet him. He usually wears a sport jacket or a blazer, and he can't button his sport jacket or blazer. There isn't a blazer made big enough. His chest just comes out of the thing, and he's got a neck on him the size of most people's waist. So this is a big man, but it's not fat. It's all muscle. In fact, one of his colleagues told me later on when he was in Iran, this is years afterward, he said he roomed with Rich Armitage, and he said before breakfast he'd do 200 sit-ups and 300 push-ups before breakfast. So this is a physical specimen of a man, and at this point he's about 30 years old. He is 30 years old. So he sees Admiral Whitmire, and he tells Admiral Whitmire what he has done. I have made this deal with the South Vietnamese Navy. And what are we going to do, Admiral? We have to honor my promise. They're expecting us to come and save them. And Whitmire makes a call to the Pentagon, I guess just to verify this guy is who he says he is. At least that's the recollection of the time. And within minutes, they come up with an agreement. He will. Admiral Whitmire will honor the agreement that Rich Armitage has made with Captain Kim Do of the South Vietnamese Navy. Where does the Kirk come into this? Well, the Kirk is cruising along. They've just unloaded many of their passengers, the Vietnamese refugee passengers, and they get a radio message for the Kirk to come alongside or have its motor whaleboat come alongside USS Blue Ridge, the command ship of the fleet. Admiral Whitmire would like to talk to Captain Jacobs. Now, Captain Jacobs is on a small vessel. He doesn't know why he's being called. He thinks he's done something terribly wrong, perhaps in recovering those aircraft. Maybe he's violated some terrible, some law, and he's going to get terrible consequences as a result. So he gets on the radio, and Admiral Whitmire says that they should come alongside. They're going to be putting a civilian aboard the motor whale boat, and Captain Jacobs is to take this civilian back to the ship and to follow his orders explicitly. This is a very strange request. The man is a civilian they're going to take aboard, and it's Richard Armitage. And he comes aboard in the middle of the night, about 9 o'clock, 9:30 in the evening, and he's dressed in a borrowed blazer. He's had a shower, he's had a shave, and someone has loaned him a blazer and a tie. And everyone sees this, and this is a very weird sight to see in the South China Sea. The humidity is, 110%. The bulkheads are dripping with humidity. Everybody is dressed in shorts or whatever. And here's this guy comes aboard in a blazer, and he's carrying a .45 in a shoulder holster.
And he's really big.
He's a very big man. And he comes aboard, and immediately they have a meeting, and what's going on? And he says, we're going to Vietnam. We're going back to South Vietnam tonight. Our mission is to save the South Vietnamese Navy. We're going to rendezvous with them at Con Son Island. Now, this is a very unusual thing in the U.S. Navy, because naval officers are not yet used to taking their orders from a civilian. The only civilians they take their orders from are the Secretary of the Navy and the Secretary of Defense. And here's this 30-year-old guy, as big as he is, and now he's given the orders. Captain Jacobs feels a little uncomfortable about this. There is no written orders, because he comments. He says, where are the written orders? There aren't any. And so Captain Jacobs gets on a secure phone, and he talks to Admiral Whitmire, and Admiral Whitmire says, he's my man, do as he says. They steam all night. Go ahead.
This is a pretty big deal. I mean, this is not a small thing for the captain of a warship.
Not at all. And now, who's going with us? Nobody. We're going down alone. Now, this is a pretty scary thing now. South Vietnam is now in the hands of the communists, North Vietnamese. All the airfields are now in control of the North Vietnamese. And many of our aircraft, which are still left behind, are now probably being flown by either defectors or people who know how to fly them. And the Kirk has a 5-inch deck gun. That's its defense. And it's being sent back to South Vietnam to rescue the South Vietnamese Navy. They steam all night, and they get to Con Son Island in the early morning hours as the sun is coming up, and there they see roughly 32 ships of the South Vietnamese Navy, the types of ships I mentioned earlier. And that they're expecting, because that's what Armitage has said they should expect. But when they look on the decks, they see something they don't expect. They see roughly 30,000 refugees on the decks of these ships. One sailor later says, it reminded me of putting a Hershey bar on the sidewalk in the summer and coming back an hour later to find it covered with ants. That's what these decks looked like. Men, women, children, clogging decks as thick as you could possibly settle them on a deck. Not even sitting room. They're all standing, and they haven't been with food. They've had no food, no water. Few have had any kind of medical care in probably several days. And now the Kirk has to somehow bring these people across the South China Sea by itself. And the South China Sea is not a calm body of water under normal circumstances. How are they going to pull this off? Captain Jacobs is probably at this point praying to his deity. He's praying to God to figure out a way how he's going to get these people somehow across the South China Sea without losing half of them. And that's the story. How do they do it? How do they pull it off? How do they get these ships underway, many of them that are not operating properly? He puts his engineers aboard. They get engines operating again. Some of them don't have anchors. Some of them, the anchors are fouled on the bottom, and they can't get them up. So they have to get acetylene cutting torches to cut the chain. And as far as medical care and food, he's got to provide food and water to 30,000 people. How are they going to do that? And as far as medical care, he's got two corpsmen, two hospital corpsmen aboard his ship. He's got a tiny sick bay with a chief and a third-class hospital corpsman. Put the hospital corpsman in a small boat, and they go from ship to ship holding sick call. They get the ships underway, and they proceed eastward across the South China Sea. And eventually, to get some help, they get other ships to help them out, to provide rice and food and medical care and all that kind of stuff. And even the U.S. Air Force weighs in at one point during this operation. That's the story. That's the real story of the heroism of the USS Kirk, how they pull it off. And they do pull
it off. Mind you, they had a good day on the 29th. They rescued 140-some-odd people. That's not a bad day's work. And what they now get to do is take 30,000 refugees in a bunch of straw-bottom boats and take them to the Philippines. Except they aren't exactly welcome in the Philippines, are they?
No, there's a problem. It's a major problem. Here, they're underway for several days. Mind you, to get from Consan Island to Subic Bay in the Philippines, where we have a naval base, is roughly, that's close to 1,000 miles. It's 900 and some odd miles. And remember, they can only proceed as quickly as the slowest vessel in the convoy. And it is a convoy, a two-column convoy they put together. So it's taken a while to get there. Fortunately for them, the water is calm. It's like a mill pond for about 7 days. So thankfully, the good Lord is watching after them as far as the weather is concerned. But they finally get within the territorial waters or close to territorial waters of the Philippines, and they get word that President Ferdinand Marcos is not going to let these ships into the Philippines. And now they have a real problem. What are we going to do? These people are at the end of their rope. They've been out at sea. They've been in these terribly crowded conditions. Disease is starting to spread through these population of refugees. The water is running out. The food is running out. And these people are not happy. They're not happy for a variety of reasons. Many of them have left relatives back in Vietnam. Many of them have lost everything they own. Many of them have witnessed the death of loved ones at the hands of the communists. And the idea that the possibility is that they could go back to Vietnam, what if the Americans decide, and they don't know, what if the Americans decide to go back with us to Vietnam? The Americans are thinking they'll be rioting on these ships if there's any possibility that these people are going to be taken back to Vietnam. But now Ferdinand Marcos says, they're not coming into my country. He has several reasons for saying this. He is recognizing the reality, the new reality, the new diplomatic reality of Southeast Asia. The United States, which is the Philippine ally, has just abandoned another ally, the South Vietnamese.
A next-door ally, by the way.
Pardon?
An ally right next door to the Philippines.
Exactly,
was staring down the barrel of China and North Vietnam right now.
Exactly. So here you have a situation where Marcos is starting to make nice to the North Vietnamese. Mind you, the North Vietnamese have already made a protest to the Philippine government. They know about the escape of the South Vietnamese Navy, and they tell Marcos, we want our ships back, and we want the people on them back. So Marcos is in this very delicate position, at least the way he sees it. He's trying to make nice to the victors in this war. He realizes that the Americans have abandoned South Vietnam, and if they've abandoned South Vietnam, what's to say they're not going to abandon the Philippines as an ally? So rather than offend the North Vietnamese, he says, they're not coming in here. Now we have a crisis on our hands Captain Jacobs has to deal with. What do we do?
Well, he has a talented young man by the name of Richard Armitage there, and Armitage has a friend in the Philippines, an ambassador by the name of Sullivan.
Well, it's not clear exactly whether Armitage knows Sullivan at this point, but Sullivan is one of Kissinger's boys. Sullivan is a very talented and very experienced diplomat. He is now made aware of this crisis and doesn't exactly know how he's going to deal with it. He's going to have to somehow get Marcos to change his mind. And he doesn't have a lot of time to do it because time is running out on these people and on this flotilla that's now has stopped. Well, they actually haven't stopped dead in the water. They're making a circuitous circle to kill time until the diplomats can work this thing out. And hopefully they can. At least that's how Captain Jacobs feels. Anyway, it turns out that that Ambassador Sullivan has a very close relationship with Ferdinand Marcos. Marcos respects him very, very much. They've become friendly, and they respect each other. And it turns out that they're giving a speech. Two of them are giving two speeches at the same event, commemoration of the fall of Corregidor during World War II, at the beginning of World War II, 1942. And they both share the platform. And Marcos gives his speech, and Master Sullivan gives his speech. And then as they go back to their seats and they begin to leave the stage, Ambassador Sullivan finds his opportunity. And he says to President Marcos, he says, "We have this issue. We have to solve it. These people are in dire straits. Can you please let them in?" And Marcos says, "No, I can't let them in. I can't do that." And being a quick-thinking diplomat as he is, Ambassador Sullivan says, "You know, the ships that those people are on were once American Navy ships. And under our military assistance agreement, we loan those ships to the South Vietnamese. And it's in the legislation, if that nation no longer needs those ships, they can revert back to American control. What if the ships come in under American flags as U.S. Navy ships and not South Vietnamese ships?" Of course, by this time, South Vietnamese has ceased to exist, so the flag doesn't really mean anything. And Marcos looks at him and says, "That's an interesting proposition." And he says, "The other thing is, you know, there's probably, being that these are older ships that we have in our Navy now, there's a good likelihood that the U.S. Navy would not want to have these ships back in the U.S. Navy on a permanent basis. I could put in a good word and mention that you might like to have these ships in your Philippine Navy." Well, suddenly
Suddenly has facing him is a deal, one that he gets something for nothing, and all he has to do is let the Navy bring these people in and ship them off to America or wherever they are to go.
That's exactly what happens. Within minutes, and this is the way Ambassador Sullivan recalls, within minutes there's a handshake, there are some other issues that need to be resolved, but they're resolved very quickly. The South Vietnamese refugees will only remain in the Philippines for a few days, and then the United States will find another place for them. The ships end up in the South Vietnamese Navy, those that are still serviceable, and the others they keep for parts, because many of the ships in the Philippine Navy are of the same type and can use spare parts. So the deal is made. The ships need to be disarmed, and that's part of the deal. And all of them need to come in to Subic Bay, into the naval base, the U.S. naval base at Subic Bay, under American flags and American commanders. And so that is the deal that is made. And the ships are allowed in as a result of that.
And so you've got these ships coming in, being captained by junior officers and petty officers and other things, anybody they could put aboard as a prize crew to go ahead and hoist a flag and bring them on in.
That's exactly what happens, and it's a very emotional time. Many of the men who are on these South Vietnamese or former South Vietnamese ships are crew members of USS Kirk, as you point out, petty officers, officers, and they've managed to find enough flags not only in the old flag locker on Kirk, but other ships, other Navy ships that are now helping in this. Because I don't want to make this sound like it's a Lone Ranger operation. By the time they get about a third the way across, many Navy ships are providing help. It's not just the Kirk, although the Kirk is the lead ship in all of this. There are other ships providing aid. And so they find enough U.S. flags, and they go aboard, and now it's a matter of how do you sweeten the pill for these people who are dispirited, who have just lost their country, who have lost everything. And so they hold ceremonies aboard each of these ships. Very emotional, as many of these refugees remember years later, very emotional. In which they sing their national anthem for the last time. They see their flag for the last time they'll ever be under that flag. And Vietnamese flags are lowered on these ships, and the American flags are raised, and the ships come in as U.S. Navy ships.
And at that point, all of these refugees pile off. They are given medical examination.
They come off the ship. There's a temporary refugee camp set up on Grandy Island in the bay there and near Subic. And then the Vietnamese are put aboard transports, U.S. transports that are either contracted or military sealift command transports, and are given appropriate food and medical care and are sent on to Guam, where there is a huge refugee camp on Guam. And they're on Guam for some time, and then little by little they're brought to the continental U.S., and there are refugee camps set up, very quickly set up and very efficiently set up in several locations, Camp Pendleton on the west coast, Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, Fort Indian Town Gap, Pennsylvania, up near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and several others, several other camps. And these people are eventually sponsored by either churches or synagogues or private families or whatever. Families are sponsored. People get them apartments, get them jobs, and eventually many of these people, not all of them settle in the U.S., I should say. Some of them settle in Australia, but the preponderance of them settle in the United States. And today there are Vietnamese-American communities, fairly large. Orange County, California has the largest. There is some here in Northern Virginia, in Fairfax and Arlington. In New Orleans, the New Orleans area, up in the Seattle area, there's another community of South Vietnamese. And there are also South Vietnamese living, believe it or not, in Germany, in Scandinavia, in France, and even in Great Britain. But many of them, most of them, are in this country today. And many of them have become citizens. And there are now second and third generation Vietnamese Americans living among us as citizens of the United States.
Not bad. And the question also arises, what happens to the Kirk and Captain Jacobs and his crew?
Well, the ship was in dire need of yard work after what it had just been through. The decks were pretty much messed up with the dragging of Hueys across them. The ship needed a yard work, so it went in for an overhaul, and it ended up going to Japan. Eventually, the ship stayed in the U.S. Navy until about 1993, I think, during that year. And by then, it had been redesignated. It was no longer a DE, a destroyer escort. It was an FF, a frigate. And that whole class of Knox-class destroyer escorts became frigates, at least by name anyway. The Kirk ended up being sold to the government of Taiwan. It's still active in the Taiwanese Navy as the Fenyang is its new name. But if you look at photographs of the Fenyang, and it's in really good condition, the Taiwanese have kept it in very, very good condition, you can see a raised weld on the transom, which says Kirk. So the ship is still around. I've joked with the captain and some crew members and said, we'd like to lead a raid on Taiwan with Captain Jacobs and steal the ship and bring it back, and I don't think there'd be a shortage of crew members who wouldn't want to do that. They love that ship and what it represents.
Now, this is an amazing little story that very few people know, and your new book with Naval Institute Press certainly goes a ways towards telling that story. How did you become involved with the story of USS Kirk and her crew and this series of events? How did you get involved with them?
Well, my previous, before retiring, I was the Navy's medical historian for 33 years, and I wrote a series of books. It was a trilogy on the wars that Navy medicine had participated in, beginning with World War II, Korea, and, of course, Vietnam, which was my generation's war. I was in the service at that time, not in the Navy. I was in the Air Force. But I was writing a book about Navy medicine in Vietnam, and I got to the last chapter. And the last chapter, of course, was the last chapter of the war in Vietnam, the fall of Saigon. And I knew about the flotilla of ships, and I knew about the rescue of many of these people. And I wanted to interview, for the last chapter of my book on Vietnam, I wanted to interview medical personnel who had served aboard these ships. And so I found the names of the ships and looked, as we do these days, I went online, and I found reunion organizations that were still around that represented some of these ships. And I said I wanted to interview crew members, and I sent emails to the contact people in these reunion groups. Within an hour of hitting the send on my computer, I got a phone call from Paul Jacobs, who lives in Gainesville, Virginia, out near Manassas. He called me and said, my ship took part in this. He didn't at that time tell me that it had a special role to play, that is the rescue of the South Vietnamese Navy, but we became friendly, and I interviewed him, I interviewed his crew, and then suddenly realized that this was not just another ship in the flotilla. It had a special role to play, and I was just lucky enough to have picked the right ship, or lucky enough that the skipper of that right ship had gotten back in touch with me. And that was the beginning of it.
This led obviously to you becoming very involved with the story.
Very
involved. Ironically, you didn't do a book first. You did a movie about it first, right?
Exactly. I worked directly for the Navy Surgeon General at that time, Vice Admiral Adam Robinson, who was the Surgeon General of the Navy then, back about 2007. And one day, Captain Jacobs asked me, he called me and said, we're having a reunion of the Kirk, and we're going to have many of the South Vietnamese who we rescued, and they haven't seen their rescuers, and the crew members haven't seen these people in 35 years. And do you think Admiral Robinson would come to the reunion? And I said, well, gee, I really can't speak for the Admiral. He's brand new in the job. He just came aboard recently, and you might send him an invitation, see what he says. And it was about a week or so later, the Admiral called me at my office and wanted to know what this USS Kirk was all about. What's the story on this ship, the USS Kirk? I've been invited to a reunion, and why should I go? And I said, Admiral, I told him briefly the story. I said, Admiral, if you don't go, I think you're going to be very sorry you didn't. Well, as a result, he decided to go to the reunion, and he had a speech prepared. He was going to be the honored after-dinner speaker. And we went to the reunion out in Gainesville, and it was a very emotional night for a lot of people because, as I said, many of these people had not seen each other since 1975. So there was a lot of hugging and kissing going on at this dinner. The Admiral finally was introduced to give his speech, and he took his prepared text and he threw it down on a table next to where he was speaking and said, I'm not giving this speech. It's totally inappropriate after what I've seen tonight. And he went on and he spoke for about 20 minutes from the heart as to what humanitarian assistance means in the U.S. Navy and how the U.S. Navy has provided humanitarian assistance over the ages. And shortly thereafter, he invited, that is, Admiral Robinson, invited Captain Jacobs to lunch at his headquarters in Washington. He invited me. I was sitting around, and the Admiral looked at me and he said, I know you make documentary films. He said, you need to make a documentary about the USS Kirk. Americans need to know this story. And I thought it was idle lunchtime chatter at the time. I didn't know if he was serious, but I think it was during the dessert course. I looked at him and I said, Admiral, are you really serious? You'd like me to make a film about this? And he looked at me as only a three-star admiral can, just pierced me with his eyes and said, would I have suggested it if I weren't serious? And so within a few hours, the documents were signed for me to make this film, which took 2 years to make. We went all over the country interviewing former Vietnamese refugees, crew members, and a whole bunch of other folks. We made a film. It was shown. It had its premiere at the Smithsonian on Veterans Day of 2010. National Public Radio picked up the story and ran several stories on NPR about the USS Kirk. Now, again,
you
point out,
for our listeners, you can find this film, The Lucky Few, same name as the book, on Amazon. You can order a copy of it. You can also do a Google search for it and find it in full length on several websites that are hosting it right now. Please continue, Jan.
Anyway, the film was shown, and NPR picked it up. And as I pointed out, or you pointed out earlier, normally the way these things work is you write the book, and then, if you're lucky, you make the movie. I just did things backwards. I made the movie, and then I wrote the book. And what the book is, it's all what you might find, which ended up on the cutting room floor, as they say, that didn't make it into the one-hour movie, made it into the book. So the book tells the complete story as completely as I can tell it. The movie is an illustration of what the book now talks about. It talks about this heroic rescue. And again, it's one of those things you don't normally run into. As I said, Vietnam was not a happy experience for many people. This is a happy experience. Many of these refugees have turned out to be wonderful citizens of the United States. They've added to our culture. I don't know how much time we have, but there is that story I think I talked to you about the other day about
the engineer. And I'd like to close the show with that story, if you don't mind, Jay, because...
Not at all.
I think it encapsulates the entire story of the rescue of all those 30,000 people in a special way that resonates across the years and the decades. Please go ahead, and we'll finish with that.
Okay. The engineer of the Kirk, Hugh Doyle, spent the rest of his career in the Navy, retired as a commander, ended up moving to Newport, Rhode Island. And as a Navy veteran and a retiree, he gets medical care from the Navy even today. So he gets his medical care at the Naval Station at Newport. About a year and a half ago, he went to have his annual physical at the clinic at Newport at the Naval Station, and his regular Navy physician was not there any longer. He had been reassigned to a hospital down in Florida, Naval Hospital Pensacola. And his new physician was a commander named Con Nguyen, Vietnamese name. Well, he has his first visit, and he says to Commander Nguyen, he says, "I notice you have a Vietnamese name. How did your family get here?" And Commander Nguyen says, "I really can't tell you very much. We came on a ship. I was a five-year-old boy at the time. My father and mother never talked about it, never talked about the experience. My father is now deceased. My mother speaks only Vietnamese, and she has never talked about it. So I really don't know." So Hugh Doyle had a copy of The Lucky Few, the film, in his car, and he gave him a copy. He gave him a DVD, and he said, "Look at this and tell me if it means anything to you, if it tells you anything about your story." And he came back for his next appointment several weeks later, and he asked Dr. Nguyen. Dr. Nguyen said, "I saw the film, but it means nothing to me. It's a nice film, but it tells me nothing further that I don't already know about my history." He said, "But my sister, who lives on the West Coast, is coming to town to bring our niece and to go to college, and they're going to stay with us, and I'll show her the film." The next time Hugh Doyle went to the clinic, Dr. Nguyen was all excited. He said, "My sister saw the movie. She saw the ship we came on. She recognized the hull number, HQ3, and she got all excited and said, that is the ship we came on. And I remember a small Navy ship coming around and providing us with health, with medical care and food and rice and water and all that." So it turns out that indeed it was the USS Kirk that rescued his family. And Hugh Doyle says now, what are the odds this family would have made it out of Vietnam at the end of the Vietnam War? What are the odds they would have made it all the way to the United States? They would have raised a son who went to medical school, a son who decided to join the Navy, became a Navy physician, and a son that then became assigned to the Naval Clinic here in Newport. And now the young boy that we rescued is now taking care of me.
And that pretty much summarizes what the Navy and its humanitarian assistance role is all about. And today, as we watch the George Washington Battle Group and other elements of the United States Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force team work in the Philippines, we are reminded once again of the fine work that the Navy and other services do when they get the chance. Jay, I want to thank you for coming and spending a great, great time with us. I hope we get to find another reason to talk to you again soon.
I certainly hope so. It's been an honor and a pleasure to talk with your audience.
Jay, thank you, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thank you.
And with that, we come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. This one ran a little long, but I think you'll agree it was a good story and one that I'm glad we got to tell here. We'll be back next Monday. Please join us at 1 o'clock Eastern next week. We'll be back with another episode of Military Monday. This is John Gresham signing off for the Right Stream Network.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? I saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. Cherished freedom, freedom never cried. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man. The song to a dead man. Cherished freedom, freedom never cried. You can cry for her, die for her, lay down your life for her, kiss and wave goodbye to her, anything at all. You can cry for her. There's a baby on the doorstep, wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep, longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep, who gives his life to take. A flat to a pawn shop. Pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying so dead.